The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, folks, we're going to start in again. That's not to say that you have to finish your lunch, because we're still in the luncheon program. And we're very lucky. As a matter of fact, what I should probably say is that we're ready to start the webcast for the luncheon presentation right now. Welcome back, everyone. For the next part of your not just viewing enjoyment, but your academic stimulation, we're going to have a luncheon speaker who probably needs no introduction, so I'll skip that entirely. No. Let me just mention one thing before going ahead. And I referred to this morning, but there are some people who are here now in our audience who were not here right at the outset this morning. What you see behind you is just a small excerpt of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy's website. And this is something that we just developed. This portion of it is something that we just developed for purposes of this program, the State Secrets Privilege section, which lists many, many cases, more than 100 cases, and just about every piece of authority, shred of information that you would want to look at on that important academic issue, including many written by our luncheon speaker. And I want to give particular credit at this point to the CGS student researcher, Adam Burrowbridge, who's in the back row there, who carried the heaviest load on getting that into final form. And actually, he picked up on the work that was begun prior to his tenure by Solis Pinckney, who graduated from the law school last year. And without their hard work, we simply would not have been able to get this up there for you today. Not to mention the hard work of the technical staff, people here at the law school, especially Brian Rapp. And if I were to tell you that Brian and I were still going back and forth on email at 4:19 this morning, you would probably not be surprised. And it's just no secret to all of us how hard he works as well. So we appreciate that very much. Now, that's very nice. Those are people in the audience applauding who appreciate, recognize the value of both technical support and strong student assistance on matters of academic interest as well. So I'm glad that we were able to cover both of those points. Now, speaking of academic and scholarship, I think I can say without any doubt whatsoever that our next speaker is the premier scholar on the state secrets privilege and similar related substantive matters, now going back for almost 40 years, because I believe that Lou Fisher started at the Congressional Research Service 39 years ago. It was in 1970, 3 years after receiving his PhD in political science, American studies, and just about every form of government that is important. And since that time, he has written, believe it or not, more than 400 scholarly articles on the state secrets privilege, on related matters, government power, executive power, constitutional law. How about a textbook on constitutional law going back several years, for which he's received multiple awards. And what I also should mention, because it's most current, is just last week, right before this program, Dr. Fisher produced an extensive analysis of the cases that have applied a state secrets privilege case by the name of Egan. Is it Egan versus Department of the Navy versus Egan? That's the exact title. And Dr. Fisher analyzed 180 cases that have applied or perhaps misapplied the Egan Supreme Court decision, and he has a very cogent analysis of that, which has added to the scholarship in this area, and also is something that we very quickly added to the CGS website section on the state secrets privilege. So you can find that at our site. Just go to the school, put in CGS, and there it will be, and you'll find a link to that most recent scholarship. And I would dare say that 10 years from now, we're going to be talking about 500 articles that Dr. Fisher has written, because at the rate he's going, he keeps producing them one after the other, And I think he's more responsible for the scholarship in this area than anyone else. So we're so happy to have him to give our luncheon keynote presentation today. Please help me in welcoming him.
Well, like the panelists from the Justice Department, these are my personal views, not my institutional views. You'll quickly see that they're my personal views. I have several things I want to go through. One, a little bit more on the source of the state secrets privilege. We did that a little bit this morning. I've been to these conferences at the law school at American so many times, and it's such a contribution to the community and to the nation dialogue that we have. So I really value my time at the law school. So a little bit on the source of the state secrets privilege. I think there's some misconceptions worth talking about. A little deeper into Reynolds, it's a terrible decision, and we should revisit it and get the good taste of how bad that Supreme Court case is. There's a suggestion on one of the panels that when the Supreme Court decides something, that's it, and it's final, and they decide what the Constitution means. Fortunately, that's never the case. We'd be dead on arrival if we relied only on Supreme Court cases. There was an effort in the late 60s, early 70s to try to fashion a rule of evidence on the state secrets privilege, a little talk on that. The Reynolds case, I think most of you know, that came back again 50 years later, and it was a fraud in the court case, the Coram Nobis case. Some words on that, very instructive. Deference, I want to give my own views on deference, and on another word that I just think is so misused, the word disclosure. We keep talking about disclosure as though it has a meaning, and I think it usually has a misconception. Disclosure. Disclosure to what? To the New York Times? To the judge? Who? Disclosure. There's to me, a very interesting case, the El Haramain case, where a judge decided that two attorneys needed to be have clearance for C-classified information. And the Justice Department started to do that, and the party to the case, NSA, said the two attorneys have no need to know. A party to the case telling a judge how to run the courtroom. We still have to find out where that one's going. And I'll probably end with a built-in pro-executive bias in national security cases. I think there is, and I don't know what we're going to do about it, but we should recognize it. Okay, source of the state secrets privilege. Last year, Attorney General Mukasey wrote a letter to Senator Leahy, and he said that the privilege, quote, has a long and well-established pedigree. So I love words. I love words like pedigree. And if you look it up, I'm sure this is going to be important to you. Do you realize that the origin of the word pedigree is Middle French, and it means a crane's foot? A crane's foot. So Attorney General has assured us that there's something like a crane's foot here. So it's a line of ancestors, and I think we all know that there are good ancestors and bad ancestors. So that doesn't take you very far. It has a long and well-established pedigree. It's really not long, and I don't think it's well-established. If it were, we wouldn't be here today, and we wouldn't have House and Senate bills, and we wouldn't have four congressional hearings in the last couple of years. Normally, I would not want to go back before 1776, but on this Jefferson case that we've been talking about so much, I have to. Because on November 13, the Justice Department filed its brief in the Jefferson case in the Ninth Circuit. And on one page, it talks about a British 1942 submarine case that there is a footnote in the Reynolds case, but the Supreme Court doesn't talk about it, so it doesn't rely on it. But the Justice Department, in this November 13 brief, spoke about the, quote, parallel British privilege of state secrets. The brief on that same page talks about the crown privilege. I hope we don't have a crown privilege here. I thought we broke from that form of government in 1776. But here you start to see something, the long pedigree. We go back before 1776. So I would say there's no parallel system between Britain and the United States, legally, constitutionally, politically. There's no parallel. Great Britain has never adopted the American system of separation of powers and checks and balances and independent judiciary. And I think it's a dangerous argument for the Justice Department to say there's a parallel universe here. Ben talked about other universes. But no, I think if the Justice Department wants to say there's a parallel system and Great Britain appeals to us, then I think the Justice Department should embrace parliamentary supremacy. I think that should be a good idea. I don't think it wants to do that. So let's forget about pre-1776. It doesn't exist. There are cases, and one another indicia case we didn't talk about today, the Al-Masri case. The Fourth Circuit said that one of the precedents for the state secrets case is the Aaron Burr trial of 1807. I think there's nothing to that argument at all. It's a criminal case. When we talk about state secrets privilege, we're talking about civil cases of private individuals going to court. A criminal case, can you really think of the government prosecuting someone on the basis of secret evidence that the defendant cannot see? That's where that one started off, Aaron Burr. And there were two letters by General Wilkinson, but Thomas Jefferson, as president, knew that you can't prosecute someone not just in a criminal case, but for treason with a death penalty looming over the individual on the basis of letters that Aaron Burr couldn't see. So the Jefferson administration made efforts to get that document to the court. But the presiding judge, John Marshall, cut away at the government's case over and over until the point there was nothing there. In fact, Marshall would ask the government, why are you still here? There's nothing to go on. Why don't we just call this to a halt? So that's not a state secrets privilege. That's a criminal case. Okay, I think we can start a little bit with 1875. That's the Totten case. But it's a small circle of cases. It's when you decide to enter into a secret contract with the government, as was that case, enter into an agreement with President Lincoln to spy on the Confederates. There are a number of cases like that, but I would guess that less than 1% of the state secrets cases are of this nature. We have to go much further into our history before we start to see the breadth of the state secrets privilege. I think what the Totten case taught us and what the recent Tenet case taught us, that if you enter into a secret agreement with the government and you feel like you got rooked, you're not going to get any relief in a federal court because you entered into a secret agreement. It's secret, and the only way you're going to get relief is to go to that agency, whoever you entered into the secret agreement. That's it. But that's a small, small set of cases. On the same November 13 brief by the Justice Department on the Jefferson case, this is the concluding sentence in the brief. And I think you should, in a concluding sentence, hit a high note. This is it. The government would thus be faced with the untenable choice between foregoing the use of private entities, the Jefferson firm, in connection with secret government operations, that's choice one, or choice two, I don't really understand this, choice two, instead imposing onerous restrictions on the information disclosed to such private entities, itself a highly problematic outcome. I love to write. I never use the word problematic because it has six meanings, and therefore no one has any idea what that is. But just toss that aside. Onerous restrictions on the information disclosed to such private entities. I mean, Ben is knee-deep in this case, so maybe that had some meaning to you. I think when the government enters into private contracts, it has a choice. And I think one choice is entering into private contracts where the behavior and the conduct is lawful, and entering into private contracts where the conduct is unlawful. I know there are people who say that the CIA and the rest of the intelligence committees can violate laws overseas. I hope we don't accept the doctrine that the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community can violate U.S. laws, treaties, and statutes. if you buy this, and I think Ben was suggesting this, if you buy the notion that you that the federal government can enter into a private contract with private entities and that you cannot in court get to the bottom of the case, then I think the government is in a position to hire private contractors to carry out murder and theft, and I would say use private contractors to bribe witnesses to a case or bribe jurors, and all of that would be inaccessible because it's all part of the state secrets doctrine. We can't have that. Bobby Chesney mentioned some of those 1910, 1912 cases before World War I. Those are military cases involving blueprints, so that's a very small sector of the state secrets privilege. Bobby did mention the Wigmore Treatise, 1840. It's very nice what Wigmore did, because Wigmore, like us, no one can possibly understand what is meant by state secrets. It's just two words. You have no idea what it means. So what Wigmore did was to break state secrets into eight categories, hoping he could get his arms around some of those. For example, one of them, the fifth one, the doctrine that official records are irremovable and cannot be required to be taken in the original from their place of official custody to the courtroom. That's something you can sort of understand. And if that's the case, then you go in and make copies, if that's the situation. So that's what Wigmore was trying to do. Even more important, Wigmore got to the crux of the issue we're talking about. Who runs the courtroom? Who should determine the necessity for secrecy? The executive or the judiciary? This is my language. And this is Wigmore's language. He said it should be the court. Wigmore said, shall every subordinate in the department have access to the secret and not the presiding officer of justice? Cannot the constitutionally coordinate body of government share the confidence? The truth cannot be escaped that a court which abdicates its inherent function of determining the facts upon which the admissibility of evidence depends will furnish to bureaucratic officials two ample opportunities for abusing the privilege. Both principle and policy demand that the determination of the privilege shall be for the court. And notice when he talked about the language, very, very clear, determining the facts. I think Ben is correct that the facts presented to the courts in these cases, they're not facts, they're not evidence, they're someone's affidavit, someone's declaration, and it's a claim, it's an assertion. It has nothing to do with evidence, nothing to do with facts. So that is Wigmore. So 1940, the 1940s, you start to get some state secrets cases, military airplanes go down. People sue the government for negligence. The government doesn't want to give up the accident reports. But judges say you have to. You have to do that. The people are entitled to evidence to support their case. So all of that leads up to October 6, 1948, where a four-engine B-29 blows up over Waycross, Georgia, in the southern part of the state. The B-29 always had a lot of problems with engine fires. And that happened on this day. One of the engines went out, and they tried to fix it, and the second engine went out. And one way to get out of a B-29 to bail out is by opening the bomb bay doors. And that and other things must have put the plane into a spin. So suddenly even the military crew, there are eight military crew, they're having trouble even getting out of the plane. And on board were five civilian engineers. So as a result, and the plane blew up in the middle of the air, out of the eight crew, five died. And out of the five civilian engineers, four died. So first thing I did was, and I wrote a book on this in 2006 in the name of National Security, first thing I did was to read newspapers the next day just to see how they covered it. And I read 20 newspapers on the East Coast and the West Coast in the middle of the country. It was a big story, you can imagine, because the government said that the plane did have on board classified equipment, confidential equipment. You can imagine photographs in the newspapers. more details about it. And what I really wanted to do was to get a better description of it. So, of course, I went to the Air Force Times, which was in operation for 2 years, to get a really sophisticated, technically correct description of what happened. And it was a weekly, and I read the first week, and there's nothing in there, because it's sort of curious, but maybe they're doing a thorough story. It'll be in week two. It wasn't in week two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Minutes. They just didn't cover it. Just a total blackout on the Air Force covering it. And in reading 2 months of the Air Force Times, of course, a lot of stories on Air Force accidents. There are a lot of stories on planes being grounded, but nothing on this one. So what the women did, three widows, went to court and sued under the Tort Claims Act of 1946. The Tort Claims Act has a couple areas where you cannot sue the government, but it didn't apply to the women. They had a right to sue. And under the Tort Claims Act, the government is to be treated like any private party. And therefore, discovery and interrogatories, everything else part of the legal process would apply to the women. And they asked for the statements taken of the three surviving crew members, and they asked for the official accident report. Now, the government could have, and all of us can ask why this didn't happen. The government could have said, we're not going to release the accident report. We're not going to admit any negligence, but we will settle, and the two women would have got $80,000 each, and one woman would have gotten $65,000. But they decided not to do that, and they decided to eventually invoke the state secrets privilege. Not at the first. They had other arguments which were not too good. So what the district judge did was to tell the government these women have a right to the information, and they have a right to the accident report, and if you don't give them the accident report, you'll lose the case. And the government did not give up the accident report, and the government lost the case. Then it goes up to the Third Circuit, and the Third Circuit looks into this. Judge Maris, very, very well-known judge, and Judge Maris agreed with the district judge that the women had a right to the accident report, and if they don't get it, you lose the case. And the government wouldn't give it up, and they lost the case. And Judge Maris summarized the government's position this way, quote, "It is within the sole province of the Secretary of the Air Force to determine whether any privileged material is contained in the documents, and his determination of this question must be accepted by the district court without any independent consideration of the matter by it. We cannot accede to this proposition." Maris announced that a claim of privilege against disclosing evidence, quote, "involves a justiciable question traditionally within the competence of the courts, which is to be determined in accordance with the appropriate rules of evidence upon the submission of the documents in question to the judge for his examination in camera." He said to hold that an agency head, quote, "may conclusively determine the government's claim of privilege is to abdicate the judicial function and permit the executive branch of the government to infringe the independent province of the judiciary as laid down by the Constitution." So he said, as an independent court, neither Congress nor the executive, quote, "may constitutionally encroach upon the field which the Constitution has reserved for the judiciary by transferring to itself the power to decide justiciable questions which arise in cases or controversies submitted to the judicial branch for decision." Then as to the risk of sharing with a judge in camera documents concerning the case, Maris said this, "The judges of the United States are public officers whose responsibility under the Constitution is just as great as that of the heads of the executive departments. Judges may be depended upon to protect against disclosure matters which would do damage to the public interest." He said, if, as the government argued, quote, "a knowledge of background facts is necessary to enable one properly to pass on the claim of privilege, those facts also may be presented to the judge in camera." So Reynolds got off to a good head start in district court and in Third Circuit. And then it comes up to the Supreme Court. And cases depend so much on timing, and you can imagine it's getting up to the Supreme Court in the period of 1952, 1953. It's not as though the court couldn't act independently. In 1952, the Supreme Court struck down the seizure of steel mills by Truman to prosecute the war in Korea. But this is a case having to do with secrets and national security secrets. And what else is going on at the time when it gets up to the Supreme Court? You've got the Oppenheimer case. You've got Klaus Fuchs. You've got Julius and Ethel Rosenberg case, atomic secrets going to Russia, Alger Hiss. This is all coming up. The McCarthy, 1953, the McCarthy period. This was coming up. Chief Justice Vincent and the steel seizure case had dissented with two others. So he feels in the Reynolds case, he's got three justices. He needs two more. So on the Reynolds case, they have oral argument. At this point, at the Supreme Court, the government is 100% for the state secrets privilege, pushing it out. Unfortunately, we don't have oral argument. This time is a little spotty. But after oral argument, of course, the justices go back into the conference room and take an initial vote on how you're going to split. And Vincent did pick up two votes. So he had a 5-4 majority. But when this court case comes down, he's got a 6-3 majority. And for those of you who know how hard justices and how conscientious they are, I try to figure out the justice who switched from conference to the final vote was William Douglas. And I couldn't find him. I went through all the papers to see why he switched. And the best I could come up with, Vincent, when he wrote the decision and sent out the page proofs, is asking each justice, where are you? How are you going to vote? And I think Douglas was the last one. So on the back of the page proofs, there's this wonderful document. I voted the other way, but we'll go along. It's a nice opinion. William Douglas. That's the analysis. So now we have to look at Reynolds. I don't know what's more painful, reading a bad short opinion or a bad long one. This is a short one. One obvious odd thing about it is that there are the three dissenters, Jackson and Black and Frankfurter. I've never seen anything like this before. Mr. Justice Black, Mr. Justice Frankfurter, and Mr. Justice Jackson dissent substantially for the reasons set forth in the opinion of Judge Marish below, 192 F. 2nd, 987. Is it too hard for you to say exactly what you agreed with Marish about and what you disagreed substantially for the reasons? And I do have a lot of their memos that go back and forth, these three justices. Do you want to write a dissent? Because if you do, I'll join. And do you want to write a dissent? If you don't, I'll join. So this is what they come up with. So let's take a closer look at Reynolds. It is really a horrendous decision. Oh, and the formalities we talked about in a panel this morning. Everyone looks to Reynolds for formalities. So Vincent, writing for the court, said the privilege belongs to the government. It must be asserted by it. It can neither be claimed nor waived by a private party. It is not to be lightly invoked. Here's one. There must be a formal claim of privilege lodged by the head of the department, which has control over the matter after actual personal consideration by that officer. And we talked about that this morning. In the Reynolds case, the key statement was by Secretary of the Air Force Finletter. There's no reason in the world to believe that Finletter read the accident report. I've read it. It's a long, long, long report. It's very, very detailed. There's no way in the world Secretary of the Air Force is going to look at that and be personally responsible for judgment. And that's true today. I mean, there's cases where you look at someone making a declaration. There's no reason to believe that they actually looked at anything. They got some sort of a briefing, but there's no accountability. There's no responsibility. Then Vinson says the court itself must determine whether the circumstances are appropriate for the claim of privilege, and yet do so without forcing a disclosure, there's that word, of the very thing the privilege is designed to protect. So this is crosstalk here. You have to determine whether the circumstances are appropriate, and yet do so without forcing a disclosure. Well, we're not talking about disclosing it to the New York Times. We're talking about disclosing it to the court. And Vinson never insisted on that. They never looked at the accident report. So this is double talk here. Vinson, judicial control over the evidence in the case cannot be abdicated to the caprice of executive officers. Yet, that's a nice sentence, yet, we will not go so far as to say that the court may automatically require a complete disclosure to the judge. Now, he's not talking about to the newspapers, to the judge, before the claim of privilege will be accepted in any case. So he's saying that we're not going to abdicate, but we're also not going to look at it. You don't have to look at anything. You just go on some assertion or some claim by some executive person who probably didn't look at the document. Vinson says, it may be possible to satisfy the court from all the circumstances of the case that there is a reasonable danger that compulsion of the evidence will expose military matters which, in the interest of national security, should not be divulged. Even to the court, obviously, even to the court. When this is the occasion for the privilege is appropriate, and the court should not jeopardize the security which the privilege is meant to protect by insisting upon an examination of the evidence, even by the judge, alone in chambers. So that's the Reynolds case, and you can imagine when the court hands something down like that, how people over the years have tried to wrestle with it and tried to tease out of it what might make some sense. Let me stick on this word disclosure. Again in the Jefferson brief, November 13 brief, page 16, the Justice Department says, the state secrets privilege is an indispensable tool by which the executive branch carries out its obligation to protect military and state secrets from public disclosure. No one's talking about public disclosure. It's a pure canard. I told you I had no views. This is all neutral stuff. Page 40. Finally, the panel's view of the state secrets doctrine is contrary to the doctrine's basic purpose, to protect against public disclosure of information that would damage national security, to protect against public disclosure. That says a lot. So if you're worried about public disclosure, then don't disclose it to the public, but disclose it to the judge, and I think disclose it to the attorneys who are trying to represent the client. Very confusing language by the Justice Department. A little bit on deference. I testified before Senate Judiciary, and in my draft testimony, I didn't recommend that the courts give any deference to executive branch, and several people I respect a lot said my statement won't be credible. You don't have to do utmost deference, but you at least have to do deference, and I said, why? Why would a court, even before a case comes to it, already lean in the direction of the executive branch? You're not an independent court anymore. So I didn't put that in, and I'm happy to say the House bill doesn't put it in. The House bill says the court shall weigh testimony from government experts in the same manner as it does and along with any other testimony. That is, the court gives respect not just to the government, they give respect to the other side, and then it depends who's got a better case. So there's no deference, no need for deference. I also think if Congress ever went in markup in the House, there was an amendment for due deference, and that was defeated. I think once Congress goes in that direction, I don't care what it is, and particularly if Congress ever went in the direction of saying utmost deference, I mean, Congress has no business doing that. Now you're telling a court how to handle a case. You cannot do that. So I think the language in the House bill is very good. I think the Senate bill is not as good. I won't go into it, but it's kind of the Senate bill I just said I won't go into it, so of course I go into it. The court shall give substantial weight to an assertion by the United States relating to blah, blah, blah. Why give substantial weight to an assertion? Doesn't make any sense to me. An assertion by the United States relating to why public disclosure, public again, of an item of evidence would be reasonably likely to cause significant harm to the national defense or foreign policy of the United States. And then I think inconsistently the next sentence says, the court shall weigh the testimony of the government expert in the same manner as the court weighs and along with any other expert testimony in the applicable case. But the House bill is very, very nice. How much time we have? Two minutes?
Just like the word disclosure, Dr. Fisher, time is a somewhat elastic term here. We have some time flexibility flowing from the fact that we're back in this room, not having transited. I think we certainly have time for Q&A.
Yeah, let me give 1 minute. Why I said this, a built-in bias, pro-executive bias on national security case, and that is because the executive branch and the Justice Department is always in court. It's either in court as a party, or if there's two private parties, it intervenes. So it is always there and is always pumping executive power and presidential power. And there's no one on the other side. There's no reason why an attorney for a private party would either have the competence or the incentive to talk about congressional power. So you get these terrible cases ever since because it's not adversary. It's not adversary on the national security issue. So that's my last point. I'll stop.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for such a scholarly presentation. And we do indeed have time for some Q&A before we move on to our third panel. And I already see some rustling in the audience toward that. Let me start you off, if I may, with just a general question, I guess. We're presaging a little bit the next panel when we talk about legislation. But if you had to choose right now between the House bill in its current form and the Senate bill in its current form, and if you had the power to enact one into law and not the other, which would it be?
Well, I do these fantasies all the time. My fantasy is to be on the court when Sutherland finishes Curtis Wright case. I'm only 2 years old at the time, but I say, I can do a better job than that. Give it to me and I'll fix it. The same with Reynolds, the same with all these. Egan, go home, I'll fix it.
But beyond the realm of science fiction.
So I think the House bill to me is very, very sound. I think there's another difference between the House and the Senate bill. The Senate bill has always had this provision, which I know has some reason for it, namely that if you're in court and you're unable to defend yourself because of the existence of state secrets, that the judge can dismiss the case against you. I know the principle behind that, but I don't like it because it means that the telecoms can knowingly and willfully violate FISA with the government. And then they can say, well, we can't defend ourselves because of the existence of state secrets. The House bill has something more gentle, sort of in the interest of justice and so forth. So I think that's a better one. But I think the House bill is very well thought out. The three hearings, they have markup. It's a nice bill.
Let's throw out then to question on this side of the audience here first.
If there's somebody who hasn't asked a question, I would, pardon the expression, defer to that person and then ask my question.
But not utmost deference.
Speaking of deference, yes.
I didn't know if there was going to be this. Do you want?
Yes.
Why don't you ask first, since I already asked a question, and I'll follow you.
This is Mr. Alphonse. Meet Ms. Gaston here. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi. Given your long history with this issue, do you think the Obama administration and Congress would ever come to an agreement on a state secret privilege reform bill?
Well, that's probably the key question of the day.
We didn't mean it to be such a tough one, Lou.
Huh?
We didn't mean it to be such a tough one.
Now, what's going on here? Because to the extent that the Obama administration doesn't say anything, I think they're putting the knife in the back of any legislation in Congress. I think people have to hold Obama accountable for what he said on not just accountability, but that the state secrets privilege he knows has been abused. It has been used to cover up illegality and criminality. And I think people have to say, where are you on your principles? Is it just for public display, or do you really mean what you say? And I think a lot of these things are not even up to Congress after a while. I think a lot of organizations and other individuals have to say, you're damaging yourself. You're losing credibility. You cannot have, we talked about the new procedures in the Justice Department, but they're not sufficient. They're one party to the case. You can't trust one party. That's what separation of powers and checks and balances mean. So we need a check. We need a judicial check. Now, the courts could have fixed this by themselves, but they obviously are incapable of fixing it. So I think Congress has every right under Article 3, Section 2, to decide rules of evidence and to legislate and fix something that needs fixing.
Do you think they'll do it with or without the Obama administration's support? That's really the predictive question there.
Yeah, I think that's, by the way, I've talked with some members of Congress about that, and of course, Democrats would say we don't want to put Obama in a spot, make him embarrassing and so forth, and that's kind of caving in, it's not even smart in a partisan way, because I'll just give you one example where it's August 1964, we have something going on in the Gulf of Tonkin, and no one knows what happened in the second attack, but it's kind of cloudy and confusing, but it was the position of Carl Albert and other Democrats, you back your president. And Carl Albert learned in a couple of years what happens when you back a president for something stupid like the Vietnam War. And within 4 years, I mean, no party could have been more on its face than the Republican Party in 64 and 68. Nixon wins. So I don't even talk to members of Congress anymore about constitutional law. I just say, look out for your own interests. That's what you should be doing. And if you are not firm with the president, every White House, Republican, Democrat, they get into trouble, and they get you into trouble, they get the party in trouble, you all go off the cliff together. So don't defer again. Don't defer to the president. Don't say you're not going to embarrass him. Look out for the interests of the nation. It's not too late to think of the nation. Look out for your party. Look out for your own skins. Look out for reelection efforts. And don't be passive and give in to whatever the White House feels like.
I'm going to take then that as a prediction, first, that the Obama administration will not support the congressional reform effort, but that the congressional reform effort will succeed nevertheless.
Good prediction.
Okay. Question over here.
Lou, your comments raised a couple of questions in my mind, and answer them whatever order you want. How did it come to pass that Frankfurter, of all people, dissents in Reynolds? It just strikes me as contrary to everything, you know, we know about the man. And also,
it probably shocks your conscience, doesn't it?
Little con law joke.
Little con law joke there.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other question I have is references to public disclosure in Reynolds and in the proposed Senate bill. Might a judge, in light of that language, reasonably deem it inapplicable to in-camera proceedings?
What's that again? That went past me.
In light of the language that you have stressed in Reynolds and in the proposed Senate bill, public disclosure, might a judge, when a case came before him or her for an in-camera determination, find such language inapplicable and therefore not binding? Those are the two questions, the first one about Frankfurter, the second one about public disclosure.
Yeah. I don't know why Frankfurter handled, because you're right, on other cases, he looked like he was much for the national security, the compulsory flag salute case and the rest. On this one, it depends on what the judge is looking at. I mean, if the judge is looking at Reynolds, then I think from Reynolds you would draw the conclusion that if for some reason, whatever the spooky thing is, that you just don't look at it in camera. You don't look at it. But under the House bill, you need to look at it. You cannot go on the basis of a declaration or affidavits. You have to look at the evidence. And then there's the second question of whether the evidence goes to the private parties, and maybe you have to do a substitute that would be also useful to the private parties. But that's what we're trying to get away from in the congressional legislation. You have a judge operating as an independent Article III judge.
Well, speaking of questions, we have one final question over on this side of the room. And if you can identify yourself, sir.
Certainly. My name is Patrick Donaldson. I'm an alumni of the school. My question is academic in nature. I have no feeling either way. But in the House bill that we have in our packets, Section 9 is the reporting requirement. And I know the Senate bill has something similar that goes a little farther. And this might be a question better for the legislative panel, but since you're a scholar on both topics I'm going to mention, I thought I should ask you. This House bill requires that all the affidavits that were produced for a state secret claim to be provided to the Congressional Committees on Intelligence by the Justice Department within 30 days. My question is, if this is information that the executive branch did not want to be disclosed, however you want to define it, even to the court, to apply a backdoor disclosure to Congress, that wouldn't that create problems with the executive privilege? And if he didn't want to tell the court and presumably didn't want to tell Congress, doesn't this put a statutory mandate that is in conflict with his powers to prevent that?
Well, I think you can get the conflict that you just mentioned, but I also think sending up to the Intelligence Committee's affidavits, I don't know what use that has. You have a lot of affidavits. You don't have the supporting evidence behind the affidavits. Then the burden, I guess, is on the Intelligence Committees to say, well, we don't understand or have faith or trust in the affidavits, so bring us on information. I don't know what Heather just left. I don't know what point there is to that provision. But, I mean, a lot of people say, oh, well, you need a reporting requirement. I don't see what – Bert, do you know the value of that? Because Bert was there in all the drafting in the House Judiciary Committee.
Bert, could you shift over to the mic, please, just for our viewers at home, so to speak.
The only way Congress can see how the executive branch is implementing the statute and implementing their own guidelines is to see how they're doing it in specific cases, to decide either that they are complying but the statute has to be changed, or that they're not really following the intent of Congress. The only way you can do that is if you actually see the paper.
Okay. But in this case, the papers are affidavits, and I don't think they would be necessarily meaningful, would they?
Well, but Congress can then always say, yep, we want to see the underlying.
So it's a step. I'll stop with that.
In addition to being a step, it's also a very nice segue to our next panel, which is the legislative panel. But first, thank you. Help me thank Dr. Fisher for his thoughtful remarks.